Great. So before I start, I want to thank the Institute in general and Amziki in particular for inviting me to come back to the Institute. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to give a talk while I was here. I'm sorry I didn't change the date on the slides here. I was supposed to give the talk last week, but I just moved it to today. And thank you all for coming this morning. So the thing I want to talk about today is some work in progress that I'm working on, calculating higher order corrections to relative entropy and subregion complexity. In this case, I'll be doing it in the background of an ADS black hole. So when I talk about changes in these quantities, I'm calculating entanglement entropy in the ADS black hole background and subtracting off the pure ADS results. So I'm calculating a change in going from pure ADS to the ADS black hole. Okay? And I'm going to be doing it perturbatively in some small parameter, which is going to be related to the mass of the black hole, but isn't quite the mass of the black hole. We'll see exactly what that is when we get there. Before I go on further, let me mention my collaborators, Professor Shibaji Roy and his PhD student, Aranya Bhattacharya in Kolkata. So here's an outline of what I want to talk about. So I'll discuss some background information, or what I consider some background information, in the context of which we'll be doing our calculations of the changes in entanglement entropy and subregion complexity. Not all of this background information is going to be absolutely necessary in order to, you know, appreciate or understand the calculations that we'll be doing, but it's the sort of context in which I have in mind for performing these calculations and some of the motivations behind performing some of these calculations. Then I'll talk about the calculations per se, and then I'll make everything after that, though. Point three is purely speculative. We'll talk about some analogies with a first law of thermodynamics. Okay. All right. Okay. Yes. Some background information. So, so I just want to talk about some background information on the study of geometry on the gravity side and sort of generally information theory on the QFT side of the ADS-CFT correspondence. So I think to me the big step in this area was made in 2006 by Shinsei Ryu and Tadashi Takenagi, when they suggested or indicated a formula for how to calculate entanglement entropy, or the holographic dual to entanglement entropy, by doing a gravity calculation. So the idea is, this is probably familiar to everyone, okay, so you have a CFT D on the boundary. You have this, a CFT D on the boundary, and an ADS D plus one in the bulk, and you consider a subregion here called A, and it's drawn here as if it were spherical, but of course in general it could be anything. And then the idea is to, well, we want to calculate the entanglement entropy of the state of this subregion when you trace out the degrees of freedom in the outside region. And the idea is to drop a surface that penetrates into the bulk whose boundary is also the boundary of the subregion, and is also technically should be homologous to it, so there shouldn't be any kind of singularities in the intermediate region. And then you minimize the area of that surface and then divide that by some numbers in order to make it dimensionless. So here I'm multiplying by 2 pi and dividing by some power of L Planck. That's the same as dividing by 4 times G Newton. Okay. All right. And then a while later, in 2013, came this big paper by David Blanco, Horacio Cassini, Lin Yang Hong, and your very own director, Rob Myers. I'll call it the BCHM paper. And it's a pretty long paper and has a lot of information in it, but for me, the key highlight was the first law of entanglement, in which they stated that under some caveats, the change in the expectation value of the modular Hamiltonian should always be greater than or equal to the change in entanglement entropy. And that's kind of, this is kind of the context in which, so why is this relationship quite interesting among just practically? For many of the calculations, including the ones we'll do today, this change here is purely first order in some small parameter, if I'm gonna consider states which are in some way, shape, or form close to each other. Okay. And this delta expectation value of the modular Hamiltonian is purely linear order. Delta S, on the other hand, has linear order, second order, third order corrections to it. And importantly, this inequality is saturated at first order. So that tells you the main conclusion from that is that the second order correction to entanglement entropy should be purely negative, okay, in order for this inequality to be satisfied. So among other things, that's very important. You can test that in many situations. And in particular importance to what I'll be doing is that this relationship here says nothing about third order corrections or fourth order corrections or any higher order corrections, unless it so happens, and this doesn't happen in generically, and it certainly won't happen for our case. Unless it so happens as that the second order change in entanglement entropy happens to be zero, then of course you could say that third order change would have to be negative, and so on and so forth. But as long as there's a non-zero result at second or third order, then this doesn't really tell you anything about the sign of the higher order corrections yet.
You said this was true under some caveats.
Yep.
What are those?
Yeah, so so it's the example that was stated in this paper about a case where it probably shouldn't hold or wouldn't hold would be, I like the story because it's a nice physical setup. So you consider an entangling region, right? And let's say it has radius r. For simplicity, it's a spherical subregion of radius r. And you, suppose you start with a thermal state. Okay. And then, or even the vacuum. Let's start with the vacuum. That's a simpler situation. And then consider perturbing that state by adding some, a particle, a relatively isolated particle near the center of your entangling region. So by that I mean a particle whose wavelength, characteristic wavelength is, let's say, lambda, and lambda is much smaller than the radius of the entangling region, so capital R, let's say. So lambda is much smaller than R. On the one hand, we don't expect that perturbation to change entanglement entropy very much. Why? Because entanglement entropy is mostly isolated to the boundary. On the other hand, though, delta H will definitely measure that. In fact, delta H will be of order R over lambda, okay? Because the energy density of that particle is of order 1 over lambda. Okay? So that's a huge correction to delta H, but basically a zero correction to delta S. So that's a situation where this, of course, it holds, because the left-hand side goes to infinity. But it's a situation where the saturation at first order doesn't hold, and that's a story where the inequality holds, but it's the saturation doesn't hold. There's also an equal situation where you can consider where the inequality can be arbitrarily the other way around, and basically the assumptions under which this should hold are that the states that you consider should be reasonably close. Now, what does close mean? We should
How could the inequality be violated because that's just the positivity of relative entropies?
Right.
So it can't be violated ever. Otherwise, you have negative relative entropy.
Right. So the positivity of relative entropy, at least as proved in the BCHM paper, assumed that the states that you were considering were sufficiently close, okay? And they were sufficiently close and sufficiently near equilibrium. All bets are off once you consider states which are out of equilibrium, okay? So there's no proof for that. There's of course calculations in specific cases where this rule right here is satisfied, but it's entirely out of equilibrium. Okay, so that suggests that even though there's no general proof that this is true for even out of equilibrium states, that it probably is true anyway. All I'm saying is that there is no general proof for it in the case where you consider states which are very far from equilibrium.
So that Araki proof in algebraic quantum field theory, I thought that would hold. That's like a general proof that positivity of relative energy holds.
For out of equilibrium states. So I'm as far as I know, that's not the case, but maybe that's the case. Otherwise, it would be, so there are these works by Andrew Grumeler and company, for example, where they measure second order changes in entanglement entropy in an ADS, time-dependent ADS Vidya background. So that's a state which is entirely out of equilibrium. The other example is CFT2, in which one side of the CFT is at some temperature and the other side of the CFT is at some other temperature. And you consider what happens, you just let the system evolve. What happens is you have two shock waves that go out, okay, infinitely far and for infinitely long. So this is entirely out of equilibrium and never reaches equilibrium. Okay. And Andrew Grumeler and company calculated second order changes in entanglement entropy there, or second derivatives of entanglement entropy there, and they found that this was still satisfied. And that was an interesting, the point was that that was interesting, because that was a situation where there was supposed to be no general proof that this would hold. But it was a bit surprising that it still did. Okay. And it suggests that it should still hold, I mean, those were specific circumstances, but it suggests or gives evidence that this should hold in general, absolute generality. Okay. All right. Again, for our purposes, it will definitely have to hold. I'm not going to consider any situation so much more complicated than, you know, states which are near equilibrium. So I'm going to consider vacuum, just pure ADS, and I'm going to consider the thermal state, which is dual to an ADS black hole. All right. Not long thereafter, Lenny Susskind came up with this complexity equals volume conjecture. He also, of course, came up with a complexity equals action conjecture. But I won't talk about that too much, only to suffice it to say that in 2 years later, Mohsen and Lishahia suggested, you know, banking on the complexity equals volume conjecture, that the holographic dual to subregion complexity, okay, not just complexity, but subregion complexity, that is the complexity associated with the subregion, is dual to the volume contained in this RT surface. So, and it's, okay, just to be precise, it's divided by certain numbers in order to make it dimensionless. And not long thereafter, Nima Lashkari and Mark van Ramsdonk proved that Fischer information, which is related to the second order change in relative entropy, Fischer information was equal to canonical energy. So this was really great because this is a quantity that's sort of well, associated with the CFT on the boundary, and this is an energy, or this is a quantity that I can calculate, an integral that I can calculate purely in the bulk. Okay, and this canonical energy was introduced by Hollands and Wald in 2013. And then, importantly for us, we'll see exactly why this is important later, but last year, Suvik Banerjee, Joanna Erdmenger, and Debachuri Sarkar came up with this conjecture that Fischer information was dual to the changes in the volume, in the bulk. Okay. All right. So let's talk about some of these things in more detail and introduce some notation, which will be important for the rest of the talk. Yes.
Two things dual to Fischer information. So are those the same conjecture?
That's right. Yeah. So that's a good question. So let me be clear, because I'm kind of being sloppy here, putting equal signs where there probably shouldn't be. So that's an equal sign for sure. That is most definitely not an equal sign for sure. That is a squiggly at best. Okay. So this is for sure and proven. This is a conjecture. And in fact, what I'll be doing in the rest of the talk is suggesting that this conjecture is probably incorrect. By the way, this is also a conjecture. Okay, so let's talk about the BCHM paper a little bit. They considered one parameter family of CFT states. You could extend this to multi-parameter, but for simplicity, let's just consider one parameter. And the origin of that parameter space, let's call the vacuum state, or let it be the vacuum state. So that's our reference state. And then consider the reduced density matrix where we reduce on some entangling region. So the entire time in this talk, I'll be talking about subregion stuff. So entanglement entropy, subregion complexity, density matrices will always be reduced. So as a result, I'm not going to keep putting subscripts on these rows. I'm never going to consider pure state or the purifications of any of the states I consider. So, and in any case, this notation won't be used that much. So whenever I see a row, it will be the reduced density matrix associated to an entangling region. There can be a modular Hamiltonian associated with that. Of course, in general, this is very difficult to calculate, this modular Hamiltonian, but it generates the vacuum state. And in the case of a vacuum state and a spherical entangling region, the modular Hamiltonian is exactly known. And of course, there's the definition of entanglement entropy, which is just the von Neumann entropy associated with the density, reduced density matrix rho. And then you can calculate changes in these things. So you calculate the value of the expectation value of the modular Hamiltonian in this density matrix rho lambda, and you subtract off the origin, and same thing with the entanglement entropy. And then one can show the relative entropy is given by this particular difference. Okay, so the first law of entanglement is the statement, as was said earlier, that relative entropy is greater than or equal to zero. So as far as I know, but maybe this is not the case, the setting in which this was proven in BCHM, or the calculations were done in BCHM, were for states that were close, in some sense close to each other, right, near equilibrium. In which case you would expect this to hold near lambda equals zero. And whenever we're going to calculate, so for example, the Fisher information is associated to the second derivative of this guy. But it's associated to the second derivative of this guy with respect to lambda, evaluated at lambda equals zero. Okay? So it should, in general, be perturbative, but perhaps it's just generally true, no matter how far away the states are. For our purposes, we'll do perturbative calculations. Okay. So the other background information I mentioned was this connection between Fisher information and canonical energy. I won't talk about this too much because we won't really use it. I'm not going to calculate canonical energy or anything. But it's just to introduce the concept of Fisher information, which is the second derivative of the relative entropy. And the idea, of course, the statement of the first law in this case would be that this is greater than or equal to zero. And the nice thing about this paper was they showed that you could calculate this instead by doing an integral in the bulk, okay, in some region in the bulk. Exactly what that is not important for us. It's not important for this talk because I won't be calculating that specific thing. But it's quite nice that there ought to be something that you can do in the bulk, or a calculation that you can do in the bulk where you're supposed to get F exactly. This is what they showed. F is equal to E. And this has been corroborated by some calculations purely on the CFT side. So in 2016, in a CFT2, and in 2017, an arbitrary CFT. Okay, so of particular importance for us, though, in terms of motivation, was this conjecture. Again, this should be squiggly equals. This conjecture that Fisher information is dual to changes in the volume contained in the Ryu Takanagi surface. And really, maybe this is an oversimplification, but as far as I can tell, a large justification or motivation behind this conjecture is the first line here. The fact that the change in volume for an RT surface is at least second order. So the first order correction is zero. And the reason why I say that that's a big justification is because that tells you then how delta V scales as a function of lambda. It scales like, or some small parameter. It scales like lambda squared. And in the case of a black hole in the ADS black hole background, that would scale like the mass of the black hole squared. Or in particular, the mass of the black hole squared multiplied by the radius of the entangling region to some power. Okay? And it was already known that that's how Fisher information scales, by calculations by Lashkari and Van Ramstonk, okay? And others, many others, okay? So it's largely a scaling argument, I guess, is what I should say, okay? And yeah, so the conjecture is that F, Fisher information, is directly proportional to the second order change in volume. And for example, this coefficient was written down in the case of an ADS black hole. It was also written down in the case where the perturbation around pure ADS was made by a conformal dimension delta scalar. In either case, so there's always dependence on D, where D is the D in ADS D plus one. But a priori, it would seem like the coefficient in this case would also depend on delta. So in particular, whatever this relationship is, if you believe this relationship, it would have to be, it seems as though it would have to be non-universal, right? The relationship between F and delta V2 would depend on whether or not you perturb with a scalar or you perturb with a metric perturbation or an energy momentum tensor perturbation, or you perturb with a current, or you perturb with anything else, okay? So does that really make sense? I'm not 100% sure, but there's still kind of an open question here, and the reason is that this coefficient here was technically not actually calculated. Because what happens is you calculate delta V2, it's a very difficult calculation to do, and there's an arbitrary constant, or there is a constant involved in that calculation called CD, okay, called CD here. And unless you do the calculation exactly, you don't know what CD is. And so what do BES do? They divide delta V2 by CD, something which is unknown, to get rid of it, and then multiply by the coefficient which it would have, which you would have to do in order to get an equality here. Okay. All right. So that's also what they do here. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
So I guess we'll ask this, but since there's, you're saying two things are equal to the Fisher information, you have a statement about two things being equal just as a graphic statement.
That's right.
But can you understand this from the viewpoint that it's like the volume in a maximal volume slice is somehow related to the gravitational Hamiltonian York term?
Yeah, so I think there's some justification that was provided in this paper related to canonical energy, and it's actually, it banks on previous work by Miyagi, Takenagi, and a bunch of other people. It's a Japanese group that calculated this quantity in the bulk for pure states or nearby pure states. And they found, or sorry, they calculated in the on the CFT side. And what they found was that for pure states, at least, or nearby pure states, Fisher information scaled like, or, okay, so technically they calculated something called fidelity susceptibility. Okay, they should be the same for so-called classical states, which are the setting in which they did their calculation. So I'm just gonna say they calculated Fisher information. They calculated Fisher information and found that it scaled like the volume of the entangling region. Okay? So this is another justification behind suggesting that it should have to do with volume. There's some work in this paper that showed that for, or suggested that for such a duals to such states, duals to those pure states, that you would get something like volume if you calculated canonical energy. However, there's always some, well, what they said was there's some ambiguity with cutoff and with arbitrary constants, which they'll have to divide by whether or not they get exact equality or whether or not there are higher order corrections of things is unclear. Okay. But that's why I say this is a conjecture, because had they been able to show that this is exactly equal to canonical energy, then it would be done. I think already LVR showed that Fisher information is equal to canonical energy. I don't think there's any debate there. Okay, but they weren't quite able to get there. That's why I call it a conjecture. Okay. Yeah, and on top of that, right, so, right, it would be nice, therefore, to actually one test of this, or, right, I mean, it would make this story clearer if I can actually know what this coefficient is, or what the actual conjectured coefficient is. As it is, there's an unknown coefficient here. Okay? So just to just a spoiler, the point is I will calculate this coefficient, okay? So that we'll know a formula for this guy. I tried to calculate this, was unsuccessful. It would be nice if we could do it, because a priori, it could be, it seems like this coefficient should depend on delta, but there could be a miracle where the huge complicated coefficient which depends on d and delta divided by some huge complicated unknown coefficient which depends on d and delta, somehow the delta dependence cancels. That would be a very big miracle, I think. Okay. But a priori, unless you calculate it, you don't know. So this is the one motivation behind calculating CD at all. Okay. Finally, because this is actual work that was done and is relevant for us, and in fact serves as a check, or a somewhat check for the calculations that we do, there were some calculations of the second order change in complexity that was done in the literature. As far as I know, this is as far as it's gotten, by Mohsin Ali Shahia, where he considered exactly the setup I mentioned, which is ADS D plus 1 black hole of mass M, an entangling region which is a ball of radius R. Again, I repeat here the complexity formula, and you just calculate delta C, and they get this result. Well, they don't get this result. This is just true, because it's always going to scale like this. There's always going to be a solid angle. And the important part in this formula, the actual important part in this formula is what's not written in this formula, which is that there is no MR to the D term. That's just a statement that the change in volume is at least second order in the mass as opposed to first order. Okay. So that's the main content in this formula here. Otherwise, there would have been an MR to the D. And then otherwise, there's just some arbitrary unknown coefficient CD. And he stated that for ADS3, the change is zero. And for ADS4, the change is this number, 1 over 128. And then this is a quotation. Then it says, comma, dot, dot, dot. Okay. So as far as I know, we just have two data points, just these two. And there's certainly no general formula for CD. Okay. All right, so our job is to try to calculate CD and perhaps a higher order correction. So let's do the setup. So first I'll write down the metric that we're working with. So this metric of the ADS black hole with the blackening function 1 minus mz to the d. You could also work, as you notice, I'm not working in Pfefferman-Graham coordinates. You could also work in Pfefferman-Graham coordinates. I'm presenting it this way, but we did the calculation in Pfefferman-Graham coordinates as well. of course, they're the same. And then you embed your Ryu Takenagi surface. There's a couple of ways you can do that. Here, we follow the prescription in the BCHM paper where you parameterize the ADS radial direction as a function of the boundary radial direction. So Z is a function of R. You could very well, and this, as is often done in this field, actually parameterize it the other way around, R is a function of Z. I prefer this way of doing things, but I should say we also did it the other way. Okay, just to make sure it was correct. yeah, so there's a zeroth order embedding function. This is just the pure ADS result. And then we expand in higher and higher orders, and our job is to figure out what these embedding functions are, higher and higher order embedding functions are. And just so that I don't have to keep track of units all over the place, I'll measure lengths in units of the radius of the embedding, radius of the subregion, entangling subregion, capital R, so that I don't have to keep writing capital R everywhere. So x is basically just the radial direction on the boundary, and y is just the radial direction in the ADS, ADS radial direction. And lambda is the small parameter m times r to the d. Okay. All right, so our job is to calculate these embedding functions. So I've written down here the area integral for the RT surface divided by some things which are always going to show up. There's always a solid angle. There's always some power of the ADS radius. I'm going to divide by it. This makes this dimensionless. And so I've written it here in terms of the dimensionless variables. And of course, your job is to minimize this thing. Okay. Yes. All right, so here's the embedding function. Now in terms of the dimensionless variables, and like I said, the zeroth order term is just a pure ADS result, which is the square root of 1 minus x squared, or the square root of capital R squared minus little r squared, if you want it in dimension full variables. And then you plug it all back in. Okay, you expand the Euler-Lagrange equation of motion associated with this Lagrangian density here. And you find that the equations associated with the nth order embedding function look like this, which is a generalized, so-called generalized Riemann-Papritz equation. Actually, it's the homogeneous part of this equation when there is no sigma n, which is the Riemann-Papritz equation. And there's, this is just a forced Riemann-Papritz equation. And these coefficient rational functions take on some specific form. Okay. And of course, there are boundary conditions to these things. We need the yn's to vanish at 1. And we need their slope to be 0 at 0, so that they kind of look, well, I'll plot them in a second, so you'll see. And just as an example, for the first order correction, this is the kind of right-hand side you'll see. For even just the second order one, it would be almost as long as this page if I were to write it. Okay, it gets very, very complicated very, very quickly.
So sigma n is just the contributions from the lower order?
That's correct, yeah, that's correct. In order to calculate sigma 2, I would have to know y1 and plug it all in. Yeah, that's the reason why it gets harder and harder and harder. So, so this is the solution. However, it's quite simple at first order. It's reasonably simple. And this solution was already known, okay? So you'll find the solution in the BCHM paper, for example. The second order solution, however, I don't know where you'll find it. And it's some complicated expression. I have it in terms of some hypergeometric functions. I haven't written it down, but I've written a couple examples down. Here's the result for ADS3, here's the result for ADS4. So the even ADSs are far more complicated than odd ones. So in fact, ADS5 is pretty simple. It'll just be, might go up to x to the sixth or something. Okay. The odd ones always have these complicated logs sitting around. But there is a general expression for all of these things involving hypergeometric functions. It's just a bit complicated. Well, I'm sure you could possibly simplify it if you were an expert in hypergeometric identities or something.
Geometrics are for arbitrary units.
That's correct. Yeah. So unsurprisingly, you'll get hypergeometric functions whose arguments will depend on d over 2, which is the reason why it kind of alternates from being easy to complicated, easy to complicated, easy. In fact, Mathematica gives me an expression for ADS12, but it's too long, and it says, I'm not an expert in Mathematica, right? So it says like skeleton something, something or other. Okay, and I can definitely not plug it back into integrals and calculate anything. Okay, all right. All right, here's some plots about what these functions look like. So y1 was sufficiently easy, so I didn't bother plotting it. Plus, it was known already, so I've plotted here y2. I'm sorry if you can't see some of these numbers, but this is y2 here. And the colors here indicate, so the blue is ADS3, d equals 2. And this just goes down and down and down as you increase ADS. So ADS3, ADS4, ADS5, and so on. I think all the way to ADS13. And this is Y3. I didn't write down expressions for Y3, and the reason is that I don't have a general formula for it. It's just it's even more complicated. Okay, but I can plot it. And this is what Y3 looks like. And here I've just plotted an example for ADS5 of what the embedding function looks like as a function of lambda. So the key here, or the legend here, is lambda equals 0, lambda equals a quarter, lambda equals a half, lambda equals 3/4, and lambda equals 1. So of course, in the back of our minds, we have lambda supposed to be small, but I just wanted to see the effect or the maximum effect on the embedding function as I increase lambda. So the blue graph here is just the pure ADS result when lambda equals zero, and then it just gets deformed a little bit and a little bit and a little bit as you increase lambda. So, you know, all of these are pretty and whatever, but they're going to be multiplied by lambda squared and lambda cubed. So it's not really going to make that big a difference to this plot.
So, but this should be by solving the equation without expanding the plot?
No. That's a good. So, yeah, no is the answer to your question. The only ADS for which I am able to solve the equation exactly for all lambda is ADS 3. And I'll show you the solution in a second. I try to do this for ADS 4 in mathematical chokes, and same for ADS 5. So this is literally the pure ADS result plus lambda times the first order result plus lambda squared times that plus lambda cubed times this, and then stop. Yes.
So the blue curve seems to have a different feature from the other one.
Yeah, very good.
Vertically instead of.
Yeah, that's right.
What's the interpretation?
That's really important. So that was enough to cause the BES paper people to say, we'll excise ADS3 altogether and say our results hold for ADS4 and higher. In fact, they do the calculation specifically for ADS4, or their calculation specifically for ADS4. I may comment on this. So this, the fact that this is flat here is really important for a comment which I'll make in a second. For ADS3, there's a couple of things we can do. Either you can say, all right, forget ADS3. ADS3 is special. All right, fine. The other thing you can do is, of course, say analytically continue whatever results we get for ADS4 and upwards to d equals 2. That's something else you can do. The other thing you can do, which is the more correct thing, is that there are certain boundary terms which are zero for all of these guys, and they're zero because they're flat. So in other words, I can integrate these guys by parts. Like if I have a derivative of this function, I can integrate it by parts and forget the boundary because these guys are flat. But I cannot do that for ADS3. And the reason behind that is actually for ADS3, the counter terms that you would have had to add to the pure ADS result, because you can't actually calculate entanglement, entropy, or complexity without subtracting any counter terms because they're always infinite. Right? So the counter terms that you add give you finite contributions when you do them for the ADS black hole in ADS3. Okay? And those finite contributions are exactly enough to cancel whatever boundary terms that you would have had because this guy isn't flat. Okay? So I guess what I'm saying is whatever result I give for ADS3 is actually correct, but only after you pay attention to the fact that you have to subtract some finite counter terms that don't exist for ADS4 and onwards. And if you're uncomfortable with that, then I'm perfectly fine with saying forget ADS3. It's okay. All right, so let's calculate some entanglement entropy. All right, yeah, here's the result. Okay, you just plug in those functions into the area functional and just integrate it. Okay, it's some complicated thing, but it gives you a result. So these are the results. Like I said, this is known, and this is definitely also known. You will find these two results in the BCHM paper. Now, in the BCHM paper, you're not going to see the result quite in this form, but it's equivalent to it. Okay, you kind of work a little bit harder, and you can show that it's equivalent to this. This, I don't know where to find. I haven't seen anywhere, but anyway, there it is. This is pretty unintelligible as written here, so I'm going to plot it later on. and then I noticed a curiosity while I was doing this calculation, which was that to calculate, as is said many times in the BCHM paper, to calculate the nth order change in entanglement entropy, you don't need the nth order change in the embedding function. But the standard wisdom would tell you that you would need the n minus first order. So for example, if I were to calculate the first order change in entanglement entropy, I would only need y0. I would not need y1. Similarly, to calculate delta S2, I would need y1, but I would not need y2. But at least conventional wisdom would tell you if you needed to calculate delta S3, you would need to know Y2. But it so happens that for n greater than or equal to 3, we actually don't need Yn minus 1. That's quite nice. It saves us, it gets us a little bit further than we expected. Okay. And the reason has to do, oh, hello. And the reason has to do with what the integrand looks like when you just look at the contribution of yn minus 1. It always looks like this. Always proportional. Once I integrate, so it's going to look like something times yn plus something times the derivative of yn, or yn minus 1. But if you integrate yn minus 1 by parts, then it will look like some humongous thing multiplied by yn. But it turns out that that will always be proportional to an equation of motion for y0 and for y1. So it's 0. Okay. And this is where the argument about boundary terms is important, because I had to integrate by parts to do this. Okay. And in general, if you don't add the appropriate counterterm for ADS3, then this won't be 0. And this is just some code to impress upon you that the two contributions that would have contributed if I calculated y2 here, the contribution to delta S3, yeah, these are the two possible contributions, and numerically they just always cancel. I've conveniently left ADS3 out. So this is ADS4 to ADS11 because Mathematica is unable to do integrals with ADS12, and I didn't bother to stick in ADS13. It's enough data points there, I think. Okay. So that's nice. I mean, it tells you that you can get further than you expect. So if I know up to y3, I can actually calculate in principle up to delta s5. I didn't, or I tried. I calculated delta s4. Delta s5 turned out to be horrendously complicated, but anyway. All right, so now let's calculate subregion complexity instead. So there's a formula for the volume. Okay, here's the formula for the volume. I've also divided by certain quantities and multiplied by this d minus 1. It seems kind of random. But that's just to get agreement with Alicia Hia, because Alicia Hia multiplied by d minus 1. All right. Anyway, so there's a formula for it. And you plug in those yn's, and I get these formulas for delta C1 and delta C2. Sure enough, we've reproduced the fact that delta C1 is 0. And this is new, as far as I can tell. So if I plug in d equals 2, and d equals 3, sure enough, I get the first two numbers in Alicia Hia's list that he listed out in his paper. He said dot, dot, dot. I'll go a little bit further and then say dot, dot, dot. Okay. But in general, that's what the general formula looks like. Again, it's kind of unintelligible until I'll plot it in a second. And this is also something new. So I was able to calculate the change in complexity up to third order. Okay, it's much more complicated, but there it is. And I've listed out some numbers for delta C. Okay. All right, so here are some plots, because it's hard to just look at gamma functions. So here are some plots. The orange plot here is the plot of delta C2, second order change to complexity. And the blue plot here is the second order change in entanglement entropy. And what we tend to be finding is A, the fact that as I said earlier, first law of entanglement should tell you that the second order change in entanglement entropy is negative, as it is here. That fact was known already. I mean, this number here was known already. What was not necessarily known was that it seems as though complexity is always sort of opposite sign compared to the change in entanglement. As you can see here, this is the third order changes. The blue graph again is entanglement entropy, and the orange plot is subregion complexity. Okay. So as drawn here, this and like this, it seems kind of miraculous to expect that these are proportional to each other, which is essentially what the combination of the BES conjecture and Alicia Hia's conjecture would suggest. Okay. It seems a bit strange, but anyway, that's the idea. I've plotted here, just numerically, the fourth order change in entanglement entropy. Again, it's positive. That's something which is interesting. So the fact that this is purely negative, we already know by this first law of entanglement, but the fact that it's purely positive here was not suggested by anything, as far as I know. It could have been any sign, because remember, this is subleading multiplied by lambda compared to that, right? So this could have been any sign, but it turns out to be purely positive for delta S3. And it's purely positive again for delta S4.
The statement was supposed to be that the conjecture is that these are proportional to each other in some sense, which I guess could mean that they're proportional to each other with some coefficient that depends on the dimension.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
But then you could figure out what that coefficient has to be by just dividing those seconds.
Yes, sir. That's correct.
And then you can plug in and check the third order.
That's correct.
Is that what you're doing?
Well, what I'm about to do is say, all right, look, if this conjecture is just at second order, then of course I'm always going to be able to come up with a coefficient. Right? If I want to put some sort of physical significance behind this, I would say, maybe you disagree, but I would say that this should hold at all orders. The thing which is important is complexity, change in complexity, not second order change in complexity. The thing which is important is change in entanglement entropy, not second order change in entanglement entropy. At least that's my opinion anyway. So I would like, hello. I would like the proportion. It would be nice if the proportionality were the same. Obviously, of course, you can see from this plot already that it's not. Right? Here, orange is kind of similar in size in this region. I don't know. It's bigger anyway. And here, clearly the relationship is not going to be the same. Right? So, you're right. So I don't. I would suggest, therefore, that conjecture is probably not going to hold. Okay. All right. And just as an aside, as I mentioned to Lorenzo earlier, we can do this exactly for ADS3. This is the exact. This is not perturbative in lambda. This is exact, and you can show using this that the change in complexity is exactly zero. Well, all right. So those were exact calculations. There's nothing weird going on there. Now, everything I say is purely speculative. okay. Well, not everything. Okay, some things are exact. I'll say exactly what is speculative. So this is the energy momentum tensor associated with the boundary or associated with the ADS black hole. And you can calculate, just integrate T00 over the entangling region, and you get that this is the change in energy in the entangling region. And then you just stare at that for a second and see that it's quite similar to the first order change in entanglement entropy. And then you suggest this first law that delta E is equal to T delta S1, okay, where there's some proportionality constant, which is the temperature. It's often called the entanglement temperature, which is just given by something. Anyway, it's clear that they come in at the same order in lambda, right, which is crucial in this relationship. And what I was saying was that the combination of the BES conjecture and Alicia-Eyes conjecture, so again, to restate, the BES conjecture said that the second order change in entanglement entropy should be related to changes in volume, and Alicia-Eyes conjectured that changes in volume are dual to complexity, or subregion complexity. Okay. So those two together should say that the second order change in entanglement entropy ought to be proportional to the second order change in complexity. Okay, that seems unlikely, but anyway, let's follow through. Okay, and right, anyway, so there's some proportionality constant between them. I've put a minus sign here because we already know we've calculated they're of opposite sign to each other. Okay. And then you just plug it in, and this is kind of a trivial relationship now because these two terms here cancel by fiat. All right, but it seems to suggest, kind of, instead of having a relationship that holds just at first order, to just have something that would hold, good grief, something that would hold at arbitrary order. So there's some signs leading us to conjecture that, namely delta C was always of opposite sign to delta S. Okay, I've only calculated to third order. You could maybe say, oh, maybe this fails at fourth order. Yeah, that's fine. It could, I don't know. But it always seems to be of opposite sign, so that suggests that maybe we can always cancel those. Any additional terms we add to delta S, maybe we can always cancel it with delta C. And if we do, then suggest a proportionality between something that we might call work, just in analogy with the usual first law of thermodynamics. So in this, and then that would be literally what the first law of thermodynamics looks like. And in this law, entanglement would be playing the role of heat, and complexity would be playing the role of work. Of course, as I already alluded to, that really doesn't work. Because this is the coefficient, for example, that you would expect at second order for that to work at second order. But the coefficient at third order, which is much more complicated, so I haven't written it down here. But suffice it to say, it's certainly not equal to BD2. Okay. And there's a curious fact about there's an exact limit for the ratio of these two as D tends to infinity. I don't know if that's significant, but anyway, there is. So there's a couple of things you could do. You could say, well, we could just abandon a hope for a first law that looks like it has heat and work contained in it, whatever that work might be. The other thing you could do is turn this around and then suggest that this conundrum should suggest that there are other information theoretic quantities that kick in, perhaps at higher order, or perhaps kick in at second order already, in order to fill in the deficit. Okay? We don't know what those are, but we hope that this motivates looking for such things. All right, good. Are there any questions before I summarize?
Does the cosmological constant appear in your work term?
Is the cosmological constant? So.
Is it like one-ish in all of these? Or?
Yeah, so it's related to the ADS radius. So the ADS radius shows up in all of the...
Which letter is that?
Capital L. I will beg your forgiveness since I've undimensionalized pretty much everything, in which case delta L's will probably not show up unless I wrote it explicitly. Yeah, it shows up here. So certainly there's some dependence on lambda there. Cosmological.
Just because there's some like Maxwell thermodynamics types arguments that suggest a work term and the one pressure times the change in the volume, where lambda is the pressure roughly.
Yeah.
So
that's right. Well,
that
so
relates to this,
okay. So that would be very interesting. What I know is. There's some work by Ali Shahia again, later work by Ali Shahia, where he suggests a work term, but it's not a P delta V type term. It's actually a V delta P type term. And here I don't see.
Is delta V delta lambda?
Yeah, it's roughly, yeah, it's exactly. And I think I'm not 100% sure, but I think idea behind it, or why you would expect a V delta P, not a P delta V, is he's, in this particular calculation, he's fixing the volume of the entangling region. You could, if you notice, the small parameter here is M times R to the D. So there's actually two points of view that you can take, or actually a continuum of points of view that you can take. Either you're changing the mass of the black hole, or you're changing the radius of the entangling region. Because really, it's only lambda that's important. And of course, you could have anything in between. You could imagine that maybe if you take the perspective where you fix instead lambda and instead change the volume, then you might get a P delta V type term, as opposed to what Ali Shahia says, where he fixes the volume and changes lambda instead and says gets P delta V. It may very well be the case. Now, the statement here, though, is that this is definitely not related to that. So this is not a V delta V type term. However, it does kind of look like what would be a P delta V type term, because of course I'm calculating delta V. But there has to be something else, some other delta V to kick in, because as I said, this might work at second order, but it's certainly not going to work at third order or fourth order. So what would that be? I don't know. Maybe the P gets changed to something. I don't understand why delta V would change, but maybe the P changes and it gets some additional contributions. I'm not so sure. I haven't really come up with a good idea as to what the higher order corrections would have to be. Okay, so just to recap, yeah, so we calculated delta S's and delta C's up to third order. We produced some formulas for them. I plotted them around, and hopefully this is a useful fact that that gets us further in delta S than we would otherwise expect. The neat observation is that these delta S's are of opposite sign. This is known to be true by the first law of entanglement. This is not known for any reason. There's nothing that constrains this, but apparently that's true. And the opposite signs for delta C. We extended the BS plus Alicia-Ea conjecture to a general first law where entanglement plays the role of heat and complexity plays the role of work. But then we showed that whatever relationship between work and complexity would have to not be universal, it would have to be order dependent for this to work. Or other words, there would have to be something else to kick in to fill in the deficit. Outlook. All right. A lot of the calculations I've done here were specific to the ADS black hole. At least that's the case in which I did the calculation. I also tried to do the calculation in the case where the perturbation is a scalar, but we didn't get too far yet with that calculation. So it would be nice to see how general some of the statements I made are. So for example, this, which was really quite neat, because again, it allows us to get one further than we otherwise would expect. You could imagine that perhaps that's something special to the ADS black hole. It could very well be. And it would be nice to test that. Also, this idea about what else is supposed to kick in order to fix a would-be first law with a heat and a work term. We're actively thinking about that. And the other thing is analytics are really hard. So numerics, for our purposes, if all you care about, for example, is sign, or just the number, okay? Numerics are just as good. So perhaps we could do some numerical work. There's a lot of numerical work that's being done in this field. This would just be another. And then the last two are sort of connections to stuff that's currently being studied. So QNEC is an example. That's an example where you perturb the entangling region by a null in a sort of null direction and calculate changes, in this case, second order changes in entanglement. It'd be neat to know if third order changes in entanglement are interesting in that context. Partly why it hasn't been studied is because there's no reason why it should be a fixed sign, but we've just done a calculation where it was. Maybe that's specific to the ADS black hole, maybe not. But it's worth sort of thinking about how higher order corrections would be might tell you any more information in that context. The same sort of statements can be made in connection with the so-called Dowling-Nielsen cost function. The idea there is to come up with a concept or a definition of complexity purely on the CFT side or on the QFT side. And that's quite hard because so far definitions kind of depend on a reference state, which is kind of unknown a priori, and a set of unitaries, that's supposed to get you from that reference state to your target state. So the target states are the ones that you really know well, right? They might be the vacuum state of the CFT, or they might be this ADS black hole, these thermal states, or something like that. That's stuff that you know well. They have good gravitational duals. But everything beforehand, that's kind of murky. So the idea is that there's some sort of functional, like an action, which tells that you're supposed to minimize and tells you how you get from some reference state to your target state in the space of all states. That's the idea of this Dowling-Nielsen cost function. And the idea of calculating changes in complexity is, all right, so here's my target state and I kind of perturb it a little bit and calculate changes in complexity. I don't quite know really a good definition for complexity, how you get from this reference state to here. But maybe if they're sufficiently close, I can say something about changes in complexity, which are localized over here, and I don't need to know that much information about what happens beforehand, or how you get from the reference states to here, reference state to these two states. Okay? And then calculating second order change, third order change, and higher order changes in complexity might tell you something about, let's say, derivatives of a would-be cost function. Okay? That's the idea, I guess, in this regime. Okay, I think the next page is just thank you. Thank you for your attention.
Quick questions for Kevin. Yes. Very basic question. Sorry about this. In fact, so when you turn on the mesh from the vacuum, you could start considering the other CFT in principle. Now you might have a dual molecular solution. Is it the case?
You change the state, so you change it to the thermal state. Yeah.
Yes. So I guess in your construction you always consider regions that are much smaller than.
Yeah.
This. Yeah. So it's intrinsic in your construction.
That's right. Yeah. So like I said, the small parameter is the mass of the black hole multiplied by the radius, some power of the radius of the entangling region. So it's not a statement about small black holes. And it's not a statement about small entangling regions. It's a statement about small massive black hole multiplied by entangling region. So if you have a small black hole, you could conceivably have a relatively large entangling region. If you have a large black hole, you would have a small entangling region. The idea, though, is that the RT surface, sort of intuitively, the fact that that parameter is small tells you that the RT surface is nowhere close to the horizon.
Yes. But is it the same thing as the presentation that you gave us, like, in the sense that you're using a small parameter that connects states, while the small parameter also somewhat knows about the size of the region that they consider. So is it precisely the same thing?
I see. That's right. So it's important to say when I say the state, right? The state in the entangling. So the entangling region is important because I'm going to be talking not about the sort of Hamiltonian which describes the entire state, but only the modular Hamiltonian which describes the state of the subregion, right? So implicitly, there's always a statement. The subregion is part of the definition immediately. Right? It's part of the setup. That's right. So, related to that, there is some work by Rob Myers and I think Federico and company where they try to extract, or the idea, the motivation is to try to extract some information about the properties of this so-called cost function by calculating changes in complexity. But those are not changes in subregion complexity, those are changes in complexity. That's the entire state of the boundary. In principle, what I would be doing, or what they're doing, is a purification of what I'm doing. But whether or not the purification commutes with getting information about the cost function from second order changes in complexity is unclear, right? So it's not necessarily clear that, I guess they're complementary stories, these works. Okay. But it is important that I'm always taking subregion stuff.
Okay, so thank you again.
Thank you.